Today, I'm welcoming onto Radio Gorgeous a singer, actor, writer, scriptwriter, and director who went to Oxford and then landed a part in Hair, the musical. In the 70s, she had a totally original idea. The idea was an all-women music trio called Rock Bottom, on which the TV soap Rock Follies was based. We're talking about her book, The Real Rock Follies, the great girl band ripoff of 1976, and she is Annabelle Leventon. Hi, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
So three amazing singers, outrageous costumes, great lyrics. You're on the way to stardom, then something went terribly wrong. Can you tell us what happened?
Yes, it was an unusual band. It hadn't been done before. Girl groups at that time were mostly black, American, looked alike, sounded alike, wore the same wigs, same dresses, and had one lead singer. We were all actresses and singers who were already established, and we had me in the middle, being blonde, middle-class Oxford graduate and done rock singing. Gay Brown, who was 6 foot tall, scarlet-haired, ex-Deb, upper class, with a jazz rasp and nodules on her vocal cords. And Di Langton, who was pint-sized, dark-haired, working class, trained hoofer. And for some reason, the three of us together were completely electric. And it changed the way people... Well, it could have done, changed the way people thought about women and who was supposed to be up there. We all had different shapes and sizes. Not one of us was a standard looking size, whatever you're supposed to be. But the three of us together, we were sexual, you know, it was raunchy. And it snowballed so fast that our big plan, which was to write our own material, which I don't think had ever been done before, we didn't have any budget, we didn't have any backing, make our own demos, go out and talk to people on radio and play our demos before they were even singles, make an album, do live shows, do a television show about us and for us, and then go to the States and make it big. It all happened a bit too fast. And we were so busy enjoying it and giggling and showing off, really.
Isn't that the idea?
Yes, it was the idea. It was us being us and having the best time, being completely independent, being in charge of our own lives. It was a very brief moment. My God, it was exhilarating. And then several television companies were kind of interested, but they didn't know what to do with us any more than the record companies really knew what to do with us.
You're a bit frightened of you, you know. These are three, you know, independent women that never been known before.
It hadn't, and I think they found it quite shocking because also, you know, they called us a cross between the female Rolling Stones and the Marx Brothers, and they didn't know where to place us. If you're not in a nice genre, they get a bit worried.
They also like to say comic because actually you're so strong that they're frightened, I often find men. You know what I mean? There's something quite scary about the power that you had, I imagine.
Well, yes, but we used our power by being witty, by being funny, by bouncing off each other, by being spontaneous. And I think that it was, of course, a complete adrenaline rush for us. And to do it in public, the audiences were dumbfounded and on their feet. You know, it was really exciting.
And who were the audience? Who came to see you?
Well, I was trying to find out. I'm discovering now, for instance, my ex-husband, who I didn't know that I had met him, actually. I had met him because he was at drama school after me, and I was teaching there, and I had actually met him, but hadn't gone out with him. I was living with somebody else and very, very happy. But he told me, when I told him that I'd written the story of this, he said, "I came to one of your concerts." And I went, "Did you? Well, which one?" He said, "I don't know." And I said, "Well, what was it like? What do you remember?" He said, "I don't remember. Just know I was there." And the people coming out of the woodwork now who said, "Oh, God, yes, I was. I went to your first concert. Oh, my God. And I was there the night that Fumble, you did that show with Fumble, and the night that you did." And I'm starting to discover who our audience was. But Molly Parkin was at that stage doing a Friday page in the Evening Standard. And 2 weeks before our first concert, she interviewed us and she got the photographer to take a really, really rude picture of us outside the stage door of the Royal Court. And she did a full page spread saying, and I think the headline was 3 courses of rock and raunch. And we sold out. The Evening Standard was very powerful then. Mm. And of course, we were all part of a quite small stable that came from Hair, which was the first rock musical, and then Jesus Christ Superstar, and then the Rocky Horror Show, which was playing in the same theatre. It was quite a small stable, and the gay crowd came to us.
Very good people to have following you.
Oh, they're the essential ones. Yeah. They're the people you really start with, and they absolutely adored us, and we sort of knew they would. And they just went for it. So we understood what we could be, really, from performing live. So when the television company came along and said, oh, we think this is a great idea and we'd like to do it, it happened earlier than we'd expected, and we were so thrilled that we didn't say, right, what's the deal then? And let's write these things down. We'd never thought of it. We just went along with it. And then when the crunch came...
Did they do a thing, though, where they tried to stop you from performing? Didn't they have some sort of clause over you?
They put us under a little letter of contract where they didn't want us to talk about the idea of us as television while they were spending what they called huge sums of money developing it. In other words, getting one solo script. It didn't occur to me at the time that was ludicrous. But I could see why they wouldn't want us talking about it. They didn't try to stop us going on any shows or doing anything as solos. They just didn't want us talking about the idea until they'd, I guess, nailed it themselves. And I think that was the only requirement. And the other part of it was that we would decide together, Thames Television and us, on the basis of the first pilot script, whether we wanted to go ahead. The inference being that if we didn't like it and didn't want to go ahead, they would not be free to do so. Mm-hmm. But when the time came, A, we didn't get the script.
So the script just wasn't sent, was it?
No, I remember you
saying
get it.
Month after month.
Yes, our contract with them had expired. Mm. They extended it by a month and paid us a tiny bit more money, and then nothing. And we couldn't get a script. And in the end, we sent a letter and said, we really have to see this script or we won't be able. And eventually it came, and I hated it. They got it all wrong. They hadn't got the spirit of it. They got our stories. They got our backgrounds. My mother was in it called The Widow, making acid remarks about how less talented I was than the other girls, which was horribly accurate, I'm afraid. She came to our first concert, and when I asked her if there was anything about it she'd liked at all, she said, well, there was one song that I thought was all right. And I said, what was that? And she said, it was one about somebody going away. And it was a solo by Peter Straker that we hadn't even done backing vocals on. That's how much she liked us.
It sounds like she's in competition with you.
Yes, she was. She should have been a singer. Mm-hmm. That's very acute of you. Mm-hmm. And in a way, she was a classical singer, or wanted to be. And, of course, me singing made her very conflicted.
Not good enough, dear. Yeah,
yeah, none of it was quite good enough. Yeah. And, of course, it wasn't compared to classical singing.
Mm. Oh, no, that. But it was of the time.
Yeah, of course it was.
And also, you're on this roller coaster. You've been in Hair, you're a performer.
She hated that, too,
but this is all an extension of, you know, what you were doing. And also, it was in the zeitgeist, you know. Yeah. Glam rock was in. Think about what was on at the time. David Bowie,
Actually,
T-Rex.
We were the first female glam rock. Nobody had done that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if David had even done it at that stage. Mm. I don't think he had. We all knew who he was. He used to come into the same restaurant. But as a matter of fact, everybody said that Gay Brown, who was the tall red-haired one, looked more like Bowie than Bowie. And we sort of ignored him because he was just little. You know, she was a much bigger personality.
Yeah, I bet.
But... No.
Anyway, weren't you offered a record company, a record contract?
We had a record deal. Mm. We had a record deal. They brought out 2 singles and we were going to have an album. And because they knew that the television company was developing the show for us, they said they were happy to do an album deal because though we were completely off the wall, we had that kind of publicity.
Yes.
They had a way of getting the record off. Otherwise, I don't think they would have taken the chance. And the minute that Thames Television went ahead and did the show without us.
So that's what happened. That's the crunch. We've got to let the listeners know.
Ah, sorry. What happened was that... They just didn't contact us. Yeah. We couldn't get through to them. And eventually, I think we didn't do any of this because we couldn't have done it. But my boyfriend at the time, who was a composer, and we wrote all our music with him, we fielded him as the bloke who would have more authority, despite the fact he was the youngest one and was probably least experienced. He had to go and do that.
Yeah, but as we know, men respect men. It's still the same, by the way. I still don't listen to women.
Don't tell me. I know. The irony of it is that when it went fearsomely wrong, the person who had just been made head of drama at Thames Television, who needed a successful project and was driving this thing through and would not let Thames settle when everything went wrong, happened to be a woman.
Verity Lambert.
Verity Lambert.
Who I've heard of as well, yeah. Definitely, well, before I even read your book.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, Verity was a very, very high-profile woman in television. Mm. She developed Doctor Who originally. She developed that show about... the suffragettes called Shoulder to Shoulder.
Wow, so she's completely the right person to behind
it. Completely the right person. Mm. And so it was ironic that in the end she was the person who basically was so busy, in my personal view, in trying to get this product through and establish the drama department of Thames Television in a new way, that she would not brook any sharing or discussion or interference or anything.
So do you think the idea was that they got the script and thought, right, we want to own this. We don't want Rock Bottom to have any influence. Is that really what happened?
Yeah, Don went to a merchandising meeting at which they were to discuss how they were to develop things. Mm. And Don, who is nobody's fool, eventually... Verity, by her own admission, came in with a hangover and was extremely bad-tempered. And the head of marketing said, trying to get things going, said, well, now, look, let's work out who owns the rights to what. Mm-hmm. At which point Don said, well, we own the rights to the name. Mm. We own the rights to the music. We own the rights to the idea. And nobody ever spoke to us again, basically. So they went ahead and cast three lookalikes to play us. So of course we lost our recording contract and we lost everything because we would have looked like copies of ourselves.
And it went on to be a very hugely successful series, didn't it?
Yes, it won BAFTAs. It was a platinum album they got. They did two series. It was groundbreaking and considered a cult series. And it made stars of the three girls who replaced us. Charlotte Cornwell playing me, Rula Lenska playing Gay, and Julie Covington playing Di, all lookalikes.
And also the characters were the backgrounds. I mean, they did use you, you know.
They used everything, our heights, our names, the colour of our hair, our backgrounds. You never, in television series when you're writing, you never describe too closely an imaginary person, because you don't know who you're going to get to play it. So it's no good saying she's short, stocky, curly-haired if you're going to have, you know, you discover Gwyneth Paltrow is going to do it. But in this script, they did. We were absolutely described.
So so you heard about Rock Follies. Tell me the actual emotions you went through when you heard it was happening and then it was put out onto the TV.
Well, when I heard that they were recasting us, I went into shock. I didn't see how they could. I didn't see why they would. I really had no idea what was going on. So I rang the writer,
Howard
Schumann, his name is, who was a close friend of mine, to whom I'd given all these stories about us. I confided everything. He was a television writer and I played the lead in his first play, Four Thames. And we bonded. And my boyfriend, Don, did the music for all his songs.
So it was carrying on the collaboration, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm. And it was me that had gone to Howard when a very wonderful television writer... and producer called Jack Rosenthal. I don't know if people remember Jack Rosenthal,
I know him,
but Maureen Lipman was married to him, and we were all great friends because Maureen and I were at drama school together. And in fact, his play, The Knowledge, television play, she's just directed, and it's on in London right now. Fabulous. At the Charing Cross Theatre. I'm going to see it next week. Well, we wanted Jack to do it. So we asked him, and he thought about it and eventually said, I don't know enough about the music business. I couldn't inform it. It's a brilliant idea, but I don't think it's for me. And in fact, it was Maureen who said, why don't you ask that fella whose play you did? Maybe he could do it. So I spoke to Howard about it. He wasn't that interested at the time. He had his own projects. But nonetheless, I would listen to what he was planning. He would listen to what I was planning. And so he knew everything about Rock Bottom. He came to a recording when we were doing... He wrote the lyrics to one of our songs. He came to our concerts. He sat in on things, you know.
So he was a friend.
He was a friend.
Now, do you think he was tempted by the money or... I mean, he was obviously persuaded by them, wasn't he?
Do you know, I can't work it out. It's 40 years ago and I still don't know. I wish I did. I think he must have been so seduced by the idea of having a series, which is what I know he wanted terribly badly, that in the end, that's what he put first. But I'll never know. Mm. We are not friends anymore. And we haven't been friends since that phone conversation when I asked him what was going on. And he said, it's my idea. It's nothing to do with you.
What?
And I went, oh my God. And at the end of that conversation, I said, well, we'll see you in court then. And that's the last time I spoke to him. And so that was May 1975. I remember it so well.
So you said see you in court, but then you actually... But quite a few years went by. Was it because you were in so much shock that you had to kind of gather yourself?
No. It wasn't at all that. I knew I wanted to stop them going into the studio to make the series. Mm-hmm. I thought they had to be... We had to slap a writ on them right away, put an injunction on them. Mm-hmm. But... we were also, all of us, working at the time, trying to earn a living. And I was away at the time. I went to a very wonderful showbiz lawyer who had been... he was Paul Nicholas's father. His name was Oscar Buesling. And I'd known him since Hair, when he looked after all of us in the tribe. And when this went wrong, I went straight to Oscar and said, what can we do? Can we take out an injunction? And he said, yeah, you bet you can. But he wasn't 100% sure. So he sent us to get advice from a QC. A counsel. He wasn't a QC then. And I was away, so I sent Don, who said, and he came back and he was horribly brought down. And he said, we can't do it. And I said, why not? He said, because you've got, in order to prove it, in order to stop a very expensive operation going into the studio, if you're not found to be right, it could cost you £250,000. Now, we're talking 1975
here.
That's
like saying 1.5 million.
2 million.
Yeah, 2 million, yeah. Yeah.
And so I said, well, what does it matter? We haven't got any money. What does it matter? And he said, no, it matters because I would go bankrupt.
Yeah.
And I said, well, what would that matter? I was completely naive about money. He said, if I go bankrupt, people would have to pay me in cash when I go and record a record, where I go and do some arranging. And he said, nobody will, so I won't be able to work.
So you gave up on the idea. For how long did you give up the idea?
Well, I never gave up the idea, but I couldn't do it without Don's agreement. Yeah. I couldn't have done it on my own. Mm. So I then went back to Oscar and said, what the hell do we do now? And he said, well, I'll tell you what you do. We will be suing them from morning till supper time for breach of contract and breach of confidence. And I said, what's breach of confidence? And he said, oh, well, it's not established in law, but they have it in America. And it's if you've got an idea and you take it to someone in your business with a view to developing it, they're not allowed to take it away from you. I said, well, that's it. Can we do it? And he said, well, I don't know, because it's never been done. And I said, will it be very expensive? And he said, yes, you have to get legal aid.
But legal aid's great, isn't it?
Legal aid is great. But bear in mind, there's four of us, all very different people, all in different places, and all have to sign 1 million forms.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why it took so long.
So you did get the ball rolling then?
Oh, yes, right away. But it took 8 years. Wow. 8 years to get it into court. Wow. And actually, Oscar, who was the brains behind it, of course, being senior partner in his firm, wasn't the one who was going to do the drudgery of the boring work, like finding the witnesses and getting statements and compiling a chronology of what had happened so that we had something to present. So he passed me people who either weren't interested or weren't up to it or got bored, who knows. So I'd work with one for 2 years, give him a whole list of witnesses, and then he'd move on and there weren't any witnesses.
How were you feeling at the time? How was your life?
Yeah, not good. Really not good. It broke Don and me up. It was our baby. And I had turned down a lot of really good theatre work because we had a single coming out or because we were going to do a concert. I'd given up a lot for this and I was completely devastated by
it. So you were in a bad place?
I was in, emotionally in. I did some wonderful things during that time. I started directing, for instance, and I adored directing.
And but what was going on underneath?
Oh, I'd go home and cry every night. But you wouldn't have known seeing the person
being
showing up
actress.
At rehearsals. Yeah. No, you perform what you want to perform, don't you? Mm. If I'd gone around showing what I was feeling, I wouldn't have been able to work at all. Mm. So there were two me's at that stage, one crawling around on the floor sobbing and the other one going, hey, yeah, I'd like to do that. Yes, absolutely. Let's do this show. Let me go to America and do that. And off I went and did it all. It was pretty tough. And I made a lot of wonderful friends doing it and everybody knew what I'd lost. So, and people are incredibly supportive, but what can they do? You're an outcast in your own business. And if we did say anything, I only discovered somebody, put on Facebook the other day, my niece-in-law. She said, she just bought my book. And she said, I didn't know about all this. I did know about some of it, of course, not the whole thing. I had no idea what strength you must have had to do this. And she said, all I knew was when I mentioned it to an agent, they said, oh, well, she's mad. And they hadn't even met her.
Wow. What, they thought you were mad to go ahead and try.
No idea. I don't know who this agent was, but I think, oh, that's my reputation. Yeah. Well, then read the book.
Mm-hmm. So we've got to the stage where you've gone through a few junior lawyers. Mm. It's kind of going very slowly. You've got a kind of double life.
Gone on for 6 years, and I was acting and I was directing and I was this, that and the othering. And I'd met Johnny at this stage and I'd got married and I wanted to have a normal life. You know, I wanted to put it behind me. And I thought, I can't go on like this. This is ridiculous. We're not getting anywhere. So I rang Oscar and said, look, Oscar, I'm going to let it go. I've done my best. We've been 6 years doing this and we haven't got anywhere. And I want to let it drop.
Yeah, move on. Good idea.
Move on.
Yeah.
At which point there was a short pause and then a bellow of rage down the phone. And he said, you get yourself in here at 10:30 tomorrow, my girl. We'll have... And I said, well, Oscar, we won't because I'm not going to do it anymore. And he said, yes, you will. And I've got the best brains in... And I thought, oh, well, one more meeting. What does it matter? And I went in. And he said, right, you're going to meet this. And in walks a 23-year-old, unsmiling, sort of Germanic-looking, blonde-haired bloke. And I looked at him and I thought, well, he's a baby. What does he know? And Oscar said, right, this is Keith Schilling. He'll sort you out. Keith is now a super lawyer, by the way. I think there are only 12 in the world. And Keith went, oh, yeah, is this the Rock Follies case, Oscar? And he went, no, it's not. It's the Rock Bottom case, you idiot.
Yes. Very good.
And Keith just looked at me and said, I've got a room over there. Should we start? And I had a running mate. In two years, he got together what 6 years worth of other people hadn't managed. And he managed to get Di to complete her legal aid forms and Don to do this. And the whole thing came together and we got into the High Court.
Fantastic.
And then my life changed.
Fantastic. And you won.
Yeah, we won. It was pretty tough, I have to say. It was not just that the agent that I just quoted to you, which I only discovered last week, called me mad, but the other side, when they tried to prove that I was anti-authority because I'd been in hair and I'd taken my clothes off, which was the first thing they threw at me. They then, when they couldn't make it work, they got somebody in court to prove that I was a paranoid schizophrenic with such strong delusions that I'd managed to persuade the members of my group that it was my idea when it had never been. So that was very pretty scary stuff.
The strength you had to find.
Yeah, that was scary because I was a whole week in the witness box, and then I thought it was done and dusted and it was great, but 2 weeks later or 3 weeks later, I was recalled to defend myself against the charge of being a paranoid schizophrenic. It was fun, I tell you. My life on all of this has been something of a roller coaster, but that court case was something else.
I can't believe it. I just can't even imagine it. I mean, the only good thing is that you have acted in legal programmes. And you did have sort of an idea of how court works. You know, I mean...
Do you know, it's a funny thing, but when you act something... I played QCs in Crown Court and I played witnesses in Crown Court, but it does not prepare you for what the real thing is like. It really doesn't. And what I found absolutely striking on the first day in court, when we geared ourselves up for it, and there were four of us who were plaintiffs and we were very excited and nervous to have got it there, when we walk into a courtroom, Rose, this is unknown territory for us. It's their set, it's their costumes, they're the stars, they have the wigs and the robes, we're just walk-ons. And that's when I thought, this is another world. And of course it was. So finding your way through that was, I had sat in court for the purposes of acting, watching people give evidence. It's nothing like doing it yourself. And it's nothing like it. But I think for me, it was the pent up emotion and frustration of not being allowed to have my say, not being allowed to defend my baby. I did everything that my QC told me I must on no account do. He said, you've got to behave.
So you, Annabelle.
Yes, I'm afraid so. I broke all the rules on that one as well. It was because when I finally got into the witness box and I had the three defendants below me sneering and gagging at whatever I said, I mean, openly, it was really horrible. And their QC bringing up this disgusting stuff, you know, about I'd done the nude scene in hair, so therefore I was anti-authority and oh, really. And it made me so cross that I shouted, I kicked the box, I burst into tears, I made jokes. And then I got a terrible cold as well, of course, which is liable to happen when you've been so full of adrenaline and tension and it's all coming out. And when I burst into tears, the judge... to my right, I didn't dare look at him. He just got his clerk to hand me a box of Kleenex, at which point I felt safe. You know, he was letting me be myself.
He's communicating with you to just carry on, tell the story.
Yes, he didn't interrupt me. He didn't get cross with me like he did with other people. And indeed, with the defending counsel, he got very cross with him. Which was wonderful because I got very cross with him too and I was very rude to him. But he allowed all of us to have our say. And
as a woman in showbiz and you've got this reputation, at last you could be vocal. It must have... Was it cathartic?
Oh, it was just extraordinary, yes. It was extraordinary. And that's when I realised I was terribly lucky as a grammar school girl to get a state scholarship and go to Oxford.
Yes.
I was not born with a silver spoon in my mouth, but Oxford gave me something, which, of course, the theatre mostly didn't want. They didn't like argumentative, mouthy women because it undermined the directors if you're an actor.
Still
so I had to
I
shut
still
up.
Feel the same, I think.
Well, I think there's been a bit of a change. But, you know, I was mouthy and I thought... At Oxford, you could have the most equal discussions with anybody, and you had the right to say whatever you want to say, And I thought that's how the world was. Fantastic. And when I got out into theatre, I discovered, oh, no, it's not. You say, excuse me, aren't we doing this scene all wrong? It seems to me that the balance of power here surely should be with the king and not with me. No, you're an intellectual. Shut up, basically. So I discovered that the world isn't the way it was at Oxford. But getting into court, I was treated with respect. Now I want to cry because I'm learning about that process and writing the book about it has taught me so much. I think, yeah, when did I ever get respect just for being me? And I didn't much. I had it when we were doing Rock Bottom. So having that taken away was very cruel. And then,
because you were in charge, you see.
Yes, yeah. We were in charge of our own lives. Yeah. For one brief moment, we did whatever we liked.
And that's the trouble of a theatre, is that you just never have... You're waiting for the phone. Yeah.
Not only that, but when you're doing this show, if it's not your show, and you're not running it, like Barbara Streisand, say, in order to do what you wanted to do, had to take over, they called her a monster. You wouldn't call a man a monster for taking over.
He was directing his own show. Powerful and charismatic.
Yeah, but, you know, they were bitchy about her, and she achieved the most extraordinary things. Mm. But a woman is not supposed to step out of line like that.
Still, I think it's the same.
No, I think it is. I mean, I hope it's different.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, you have to... You do have to watch your step. You have to use charm instead of assertion.
Yeah.
I mean, I see people who do it brilliantly, like Joanna Lumley, standing on the steps of the Home Office, saying, yes, he's agreed, they're going to get a pension, haven't you? And this poor politician going, yes, Joanna.
Yes, but she's using everything she's got.
She's using everything she's got.
Including looks.
Yes. She's using everything, yes. And more power to her. And I think people who do that are wonderful.
Yeah, no, I think there's nothing wrong with it. I think use every weapon you have. Because, very interesting, I've just been to America and, you know, it was the thing about black people and slaves and, you know, they were owned. But women were owned by men until really quite recently.
Well, and, you know, you see what's coming up now. It's still the same. Women, you know, John Lennon was right. Women are the nigger of the world. And it is extremely hard for us to find a way of being in the world, doing what we love, enjoying our lives and being accepted and having respect. You know, Aretha Franklin knew what she was talking about. We're still fighting for it.
Totally.
And we always will.
So if you want to get your hands on a book which will change your view of women and life as we know it, and get the respect that Annabelle completely deserves, please go out and buy The Real Rock Follies, the great girl band rip-off of 1976 by Amanda Leventon, published
Annabelle.
I'll repeat that again, by Annabelle Leventon. It's published by NW1 Books.
That's also me, I want you to know, because nobody would publish the bloody thing.
Fantastic.
So I formed my own publishing company too. Hurrah!
And for even more amazing women, go to radiogorgeous.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was fun.